You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Emma-Louise Fenlon.
Since the outbreak of COVID-19, LawPod UK and the UK Human Rights Blog have addressed a number of issues arising out of the pandemic, including human rights in time of quarantine and the legislative response to the disease. Since late March, the Chief Coroner has issued 4 separate guidance notes to assist coroners to exercise their judicial decisions correctly. The most controversial of these was guidance on deaths and possible exposure in the workplace, for example, in the case of NHS and other essential workers, which was published last week. Here with me to discuss how coroners and inquest practitioners are rising to meet the challenge of inquest proceedings during lockdown is Peter Skelton QC of 1 Crown Office Row. Peter, you're very welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So, Peter, how are coroners handling hearings at the moment?
Well, from what I've heard, very few actual full inquests are going ahead at all at the moment for obvious reasons. We're under lockdown, so the coroner can't necessarily themselves get to a court safely. And they certainly can't assemble juries safely. And even doing the basic administration to get together documents is clearly compromised by the present social distancing measures, etc. So not much is progressing, although I imagine a lot of paperwork is being got through and a lot of inquests are being opened and suspended pending change in the national circumstances.
And in terms of how coroners are capable under legislation, under guidance of conducting remote hearings, how has that been dealt with so far?
The tricky thing for a coroner is that they have to be in court for the court to be properly constituted. So they need to be physically present, which makes holding an inquest, for example, much more difficult than it might holding some other form of civil proceedings. Likewise, in respect of jury inquests, at the moment, the Chief Coroner's guidance says that there are going to be no further jury inquests really until later in the year, the end of the summer. So not much is going ahead on the substantive work. So far as the PIRs are concerned, the pre-inquest review processes, again, it's quite tricky to hold a hearing without the coroner being physically present. But of course, it is possible to do a procedural hearing on the papers. And a lot of these sorts of hearings probably didn't really require a full open hearing in any event, because they're usually to do with disclosure and evidence, which can be addressed by way of written submissions. But in theory, at least, a pre-inquest review could be done by telephone or some other media platform. I've not actually heard of one being done, but so long as the coroner makes sure that there is access to the families and potentially access to the media, then they could in theory be compliant. But as I say, I haven't heard of one actually occurring.
Anecdotally, actually, a colleague mentioned to me that he had one only yesterday, which was poised to be a Rule 23 inquest, which practitioners will know is a particular kind of inquest that is conducted solely on the documents. And crucially, that can only happen when the facts are unlikely to be disputed. But in that virtual hearing, BBC Norfolk did in fact attend and the inquest was completed. So I wonder if that may be the way forward for less contentious and non-contentious inquests.
That's a really good example of one occurring. I hadn't heard of that, but yes, I think the Chief Coroner's guidance actually does say if you can do it on the papers, do. But the coroners will have to be quite careful to progress those types of inquests, because any form of objection to the substance of the evidence, in other words, what the written evidence that you're planning on reading out in or reading formally into the record, any objection can lead to a request to call the witness, in which case suddenly your attempt to do things in writing falls away.
A natural question that leads on from the vast increase in deaths caused by coronavirus will be what happens to all of those non-coronavirus deaths that are already in the system? And presumably the obvious answer is simply that there are bound to be a large series of delays for most inquests that are already in the system.
I think that's right. Inevitably, with additional deaths of 30 plus thousand in response to COVID, there's clearly going to be a huge backlog of inquests that would ordinarily have taken place during the lockdown period, and inquests that are now being bumped out of the list as a result of more urgent matters.
I would imagine that a lot are being conducted on the papers, the sort of Rule 23 process you outlined, and some may simply be no longer referred to the coroner. So quite a few deaths which may otherwise have previously been referred by practitioners in hospital may not now be being referred, just simply as a matter of pragmatism.
One of the particularly challenging issues faced by the government was how to address individuals in state detention, including police custody, prisons and immigration removal centres, given the risk of contamination. How are deaths in custody featuring coronavirus likely to be dealt with?
So deaths in custody require a inquest to take place. If it had been a COVID-19 death prior to the income of the Act, the 2020 Act, then COVID-19 was a notifiable disease and that ordinarily would have required an inquest. But Section 30 of the Act has suspended that operation. So inquests for deaths in custody will no longer automatically require juries because of the they're connected to COVID-19. However, it's still possible that they will require juries for deaths in prison where the death was felt to be connected to some form of violence, or the cause of death is unknown, or the death was otherwise unnatural. To give an example, potentially I could envisage an allegation that there had been a failure to protect a prisoner from contracting COVID-19 or an epidemic within the prison of COVID-19, and that was considered to be unnatural or a failure by prison staff to prevent that. And in those circumstances, I think a jury may well be required. In comparison, police custody deaths are slightly different, but where there is an allegation of a failure, i.e. an act or omission, a failure by a police officer to properly protect someone, I think also there could be a jury inquest for those forms of deaths. And I think it's also probably worth pointing out that Article 2 inquests may not necessarily apply to all forms of custody deaths. In 2016, there was a case called Tyrell in which the Divisional Court decided that a death of a prisoner from natural causes wouldn't trigger the state's obligation under Article 2 to have an Article 2 compliant inquest. And given that the Chief Coroner and indeed the medical profession have made it absolutely clear that COVID-19 is a natural cause of death, at least for the time being, I think it unlikely that routine deaths, as it were, deaths without some form of human culpability, some failure to protect, etc., are going to need to be Article 2 compliant, both in the prison service and outside of it.
The guidance produced so far by the Chief Coroner has, up until quite recently, not been particularly controversial. But this change in relation to the guidance note number 37, which specifically relates to exposure to coronavirus in the workplace. So typically that might include NHS staff, prison officers, care home workers and others involved in key services. This guidance was reported as purporting to advise coroners not to investigate systemic problems with the provision in particular of personal protective equipment. And I was just wondering if we could talk about that a little bit, because I don't think it's necessarily a fair reading of the guidance to suggest that no investigation into system failures will result automatically as a result of this guidance.
I think that's right. It's always been a theme of inquests that the scope is relatively narrowly defined to the circumstances, even in an Article 2 related death, the circumstances that really do bear directly on the cause of death. And coroners historically have been very reluctant to expand the ambit of their inquests to deal with high level issues like government policies, which may affect huge swathes of the community. They tend to be narrowly focused. And I think what the Chief Coroner has done in his guidance is try and reflect an already existing policy within the coronial system to keep matters directly relevant. So he's drawn a distinction between what he calls high-level government policy, where there is some case law on the Smith MOD case saying that this isn't really a matter for the coronial jurisdiction. He's drawn a distinction between that and lower-level policies that may be in a particular hospital or guidance or the provision of particular equipment in a particular hospital. So in other words, even if there may be a failure at government level to provide the NHS with hospital equipment, that isn't something that may be looked at in the inquest context, but you can look at the local policies. So the inquest is going to look at some of these issues, but just not in detail at high level.
As those practicing in inquiry law will know, One of the difficulties in setting up an inquiry such as this is that in the circumstances of COVID-19, it will be decision-making at the cabinet and prime ministerial level that is in the spotlight. So in those circumstances, how likely do you think it is that a public inquiry under the Public Inquiries Act will be chosen?
I think that's going to be a very difficult decision to be made. I think for the reasons you identify, it's a dilemma for the high-level politicians to order an inquiry effectively into their own conduct, and in particular the Prime Minister's own conduct, who of course suffered from the disease himself. Such inquiries have been previously ordered. For example, the Hutton inquiry into the death of David Kelly clearly engaged the Prime Minister and his staff, as well as the BBC. But another example, the Iraq inquiry or the Chilcot inquiry, a public inquiry wasn't ordered. That was, in fact, an inquiry run by Privy Councillors, which didn't have the same statutory powers and effectively was run in a very different way from a normal independent Inquiries Act inquiry. And one might think, not necessarily cynically, but realistically, that the reason for that was to avoid the type of independence and type of scrutiny that you get from a statutory inquiry, and instead to have an inquiry which was much easier to manage from a political perspective.
One question that those familiar with, in particular Article 2, will be asking is, what role does the European Court of Human Rights investigative obligation play here in a situation such as this, where it is government decision making at the highest level that may have called into question human rights breaches?
I think Article 2 is going to mandate some form of inquiry into deaths which may result from systemic failures by the UK government to manage the pandemic, either before it became a pandemic or during the course of its life. And the reason for that really is because that's exactly what Article 2 is designed to do. It's designed to function at a state level where the state is obliged to protect its citizens. If the systems that the state operates or puts in place are insufficient, then Article 2 requires some form of procedural investigation and a compliance investigation. In other words, one which is held in public, which has participation on the part of victims and which hears proper evidence and which comes to conclusions. To some extent, inquests, of course, discharge that on a low level when it comes to local deaths or even a group of deaths. Inquests can deal with small matters, relatively small matters. When it comes to larger matters, a public inquiry would be a classic vehicle by which Article 2 would be discharged. And I feel it's going to be inevitable that it's going to be required.
One of the things that often arises from inquests into deaths in custody, whether that be prisons or immigration detention centres, are legal actions, and particularly those based in civil and sometimes human rights law. I wonder how likely you think that there will be a large number of such cases following inquests that may indeed reveal a degree of human culpability combined with coronavirus in custody.
I think such form of litigation is highly likely in some form. I think, notwithstanding the fact that I think there is a sense in which the public services, most public services, and particularly the NHS, are doing their very best to deal with the pandemic nationally, I think undoubtedly there are going to be challenges to individual conduct which may be unreasonable or unacceptable in a particular hospital setting or a prison setting. So, for example, in the context of a potential epidemic within a prison, if someone then contracts COVID and dies, and their family alleged that there was a failure to isolate the people who initially suffered it, or at least to apply social distancing to those that didn't, then I can see there being a challenge under Article 2, or indeed under standard civil principles of negligence and duty of care to prison services, prison managers and governors. Analogous really to the failure to prevent someone from taking their own life, where there are, of course, a number of policies which are designed to stop that thing from happening, but individual managers, individual governors may on occasion lapse into failure, and that can result in civil litigation.
Peter, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today and sharing your expertise with us. One Crown Office Row will be running a series of webinars on inquests beginning in June, so do keep an eye on our website and Twitter for more details. To our listeners, I would commend articles by Gideon Barth, Suzanne Lambert, Caroline Cross and Richard Mumford, all contained in the most recent issue of the Quarterly Medical Law Review, and these address many of the topics that we've discussed in today's episode in more detail. As ever, the links to the guidance notes discussed today will be included in the usual blurb accompanying this episode on the UK Human Rights blog. Peter, thanks again.
Thanks, Emma. It was a pleasure.
LawPod UK was presented by Emma Louise Fenlon and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.